The theme for this evening's forum is The Church in Politics, Pit Bull Power or Pansy Power. And we have with us tonight Charlie Mays, who is a pastor in Port Angeles, Washington. And Mary Pellauer was supposed to be with us also, but she's right now visiting the nurse, not feeling very well. So let us hope that is something that is not too serious, and she can be with us. I think she's up at the 10:50 hour tomorrow, 10:45, whenever it's supposed to start. I'm Darius Larson. I'm a campus pastor at St. Cloud State University. And my job here as village philosopher is to try to understand the beat of the village and listen in conversations and try to see what might need further discussion. And as I was listening this week, there are several different things that make this forum something that we need to talk more about. Our last forum we were talking about demythologizing Holden, and there was a discussion about what Holden stands for, and therefore what ought the church stand for. And should we say this is where we stand with political agendas? Or maybe should we have more of a dialogical versus two monologues going all too often in the church? Also, we had one of our Vespers, was it last night? Yeah, last night was on South Africa, and how should politics and very political situations be involved in worship lives of a congregation? I've heard conversations about that. And our matins this morning, after we even decided what this was all to be about, was, I think, appropriate for this discussion. The other thing that was appropriate, which helped set the stage at least for the title, was the Republican convention going on. Thursday's headlines, those of you who saw them, reads like this: Bush snarls warning to Democrats. And then the quote underneath says, "The Democrats will find themselves up against a couple of pit bulls. We are a hunting team." So I thought, pit bulls, that's one view. And I'm not making this into Republican-Democrat. We're trying to look at this as, how does people perceive and use power? And I wanted to use other P's, and I was playing off of Bush's wimp also, but wimp wasn't a P, so pansy was as close as to a wimp as I could find. And some definitions from the dictionary. Pit bull, by the way, according to the Random House dictionary, doesn't tell you it's a dog. I love it. A pit bull is an American breed, strong and muscular, short, close-lying, stiff coat, originally developed in England. That's a pit bull. A pansy is weak and feminine, often cowardly and dull.
Wow.
Power is nothing more or nothing less than, this one definition, capacity to act. I would think it is something else, too. I would like to say the capacity to control. And with that in mind, I would like Charlie to share some comments, and then I'm not going to share all of what Mary was going to say, but just a couple, which I think are some choice definitions that she had prepared before she was not able to be with us, and then we'll throw it open to discussion, trying to feel and challenging you to feel comfortable to share what you feel about this issue, even though you may not think you have the words to back it up. If you can state the feeling, there are bound to be other people around here who have words to back that up as well. Try to keep your conversations brief and short so we can have more people to share, and raise your hand or up there, lower your hands, and I will point you out. Charlie.
It's a little bit difficult in this situation for a preacher to say a little bit. So I'm going to try that. And I don't know whether I'm a pit bull or a pansy, but I just will share with you, I am one who comes at the position thinking that the church ought to be socially and politically active. So you just, that'll take care of, in case you can't tell by my remarks. And then I'd like to just share a couple of little snippets of kinds of ways maybe of thinking about getting into this subject about whether the church belongs, the way I would put it, in the public arena. What does the church do with its power? First of all, I would refer to a book that I found helpful by Rollo May a number of years ago called Power and Innocence. And the book was very helpful to me in helping to show that as individuals, simply by our existence, we have power. And so it gets to be a matter about how we're going to use it. And I would argue that an assembly of people, whether it be an individual congregation, even small in number, or a national denomination, or a worldwide federation of denominations like the World Lutheran World Federation, has power because of its massive numbers and presence and being. That's one thing. The second thing is that it seems to me that the context seems to, and our place in the social and political context seems to dictate how we define what is political. Where we are in the whole matrix defines what we understand to be political. I want to use a story to illustrate this. A number of years ago, well, not that many years ago, because I wasn't there that long, but 3 or 4 years ago when I was the pastor at University Lutheran Church of Hope in Minneapolis, Medardo Gomez, who is the pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church in El Salvador, was a guest in our parish. During the Sunday school hour, he just answered questions. And one very astute observer, a friend of mine, said, you know, it's very interesting. Every question that we ask Pastor Gomez, who's also the bishop of the church in El Salvador, every question that we ask him was a political question. Every answer he gave was a pastoral answer. To be pastoral in that context is to be political. Moving there to the next thought. Why is it, do you suppose, that oppressive regimes are worried about the church? I think I've heard Susan and Bert and Red Birchfield mention the fact that even for people to gather to pray is seen to be a subversive act. Why do you suppose that is, if they're just sitting around talking about heaven? What is that about? So maybe where we are in our political and social context has something to say about whether we consider something to be political or not. And then the last little thing, and I hope this just starts a number of conversations. A few years ago, Pat Kiefert addressed the Minneapolis conference of the American Lutheran Church just as we were kind of going out of existence. And he made an interesting proposal, and one that I think that we in the church might want to consider. He said, what if at a church convention, instead of cranking out 10 or 15 resolutions about everything, most of which we don't know very much about, we had one very good considered debate about some issue, really had a real debate about that, and also knew something about it, in other words, had some facts about it, so that when the church spoke, we had some integrity. So that part of the difficulty I think we get into in the political arena is that we don't know what we're talking about. We don't know what we're talking about from the sources, from the source material, which is the scripture and the tradition that follows out of that, that flows out of that. And I could speak a lot about that, but I won't. And then also we don't have an awful lot of grasp a lot of times about what the facts of the situation are. We have a whole lot of gut rumbles and a whole lot of opinions. And never mind whether they make any sense or not. Example, in the political arena right now, Michael Dukakis is taking all kinds of gas about the Pledge of Allegiance, which he took an executive action on because of a court order. It was declared to be unconstitutional to require the pledge, and so he said, I'm not going to sign a law that requires that. And so because people, you know, have some different opinions about that, those become facts. Okay, that should be enough to for people to get some sense about what I think we might want to talk about.
Mary took a little different tact, and she tried to define the difference between pit bull power and pansy power. And pit bull power, she defines it as the power of domination. To see your enemies and try to subdue them is the purpose of using pit bull power. Pansy power, on the other hand, is not really different. It's a slightly different view. If power equals nasty reality, then she says, let's keep our hands off of it. So that if the power has something to do with nasty reality, pansy power is a movement away from using that power. But then she gets interesting over here when she says, many of us, in the desperation of our search, mistake passivity for gentleness. But gentleness is active. And I'm sure she would have gone long on those comments more, and they might have struck good chords to you, and you could add some illustrations there. Did any of this now, any of you have some more comments or concerns or questions or challenges so far? Let's open this up to...
What is politics?
What is politics?
We've had some things introduced into our some committees, and I didn't think they were political at all, and she shied away from them and said, oh, that's political. And so I think that very often things are labeled political, whether they are or not.
How would you define it? How
it has something to do with government and getting laws passed.
Okay. And what do you think people mean when they say this is getting too political?
Well, you're getting out in the world.
Isn't it
dangerous out there?
I think that's what it's saying. You're getting real.
When you get into politics, you're getting real.
Well, she mentioned that getting into the world, and okay. I think that's what it's saying. It's getting very real here.
But I think it's tied up with the church has been more or less pious, and we had an instance where we were trying, we were suggesting that if we make an effort to get signatures on a petition for an initiative which was to get a better minimum wage, where our minimum wage is $2.35 an hour and has been there since 1976. People are on welfare because the minimum wage isn't taking care of things. Well, anyway, it's fighting everybody. Well, we couldn't have it anywhere near the sanctuary.
The restrooms are okay?
There was plenty of places to go. We just couldn't have anywhere near the sanctuary.
Why do you think that is?
Because church and state, some people's mind.
Because
what?
Power fears that if one becomes political, that the structure will fall apart. There's a great desire to maintain a nice and calm, to keep from polarizing in order to have the institution survive. Yeah.
Let's try when we're answering questions or making comments
too, to try to say, rather than the church and all that, let's try to get into how we feel about it too. So it's very easy for me to talk about those people, but if we can talk about how I feel about that. Yes?
Well, I feel that the church thinks of itself as a we situation, that we are outside of the world, that we are protected from the world, and that the world is in another arena.
Uh-huh.
Rather than thinking of ourselves as an infection within the world itself, that we are actually a part of that world. And I really do feel that we've built our security walls so high in our churches to keep ourselves very, very free from having to make some of those really hard decisions. Mm-hmm. It's very, and what Mary says is absolutely right. You know, that gentleness doesn't mean passivity. And I do believe that we do not see ourselves as that world God loves. We see ourselves as the church God loves.
And you're saying we should see it that way?
We should see it that way. We should see it in terms of the world God loves, and that we are a part of that world.
You see, one thing that strikes me about what politics is that politics actually means disagreement. And maybe as the church, we're afraid of disagreement.
No.
The thing that I'm reading just picked up as an anthropologist speculating that at least in our white middle class culture, we tend to assume that if you have open disagreement, that's not how we reach agreement. And saying that there are other cultural models where you go head to head, and argument doesn't mean necessarily against the person, but it's a kind of dispute about how to reach agreement. And I think one of the questions here, perhaps this thing about the petitions in the church, is there may be somebody who disagrees and we don't want to admit that, or we don't have any way to allow those disagreements to come on.
Dan Erlander tells a story about a couple friends of his from Germany when he was in seminary, and they would just argue and argue and argue. And those of you who know Dan, he had trouble with that. Because to argue means to show disrespect for who you are. And at least they were saying to argue with you is to have respect for who you are. And we do have this problem that if you don't like me, Charlie? No, he likes me. He's honoring me by taking up an issue against what I said. Although Charlie and I agree.
I'd like to throw out a couple more definitions of power maybe on the table. I'd like to share a couple things from South Africa. Power, the word power for me became really enlarged and different in South Africa. Then I mean, power for me before sounded more like fiscal power, I guess. And in South Africa, especially among the church in the struggle and the people in the struggle, it has a whole different connotation. In fact, the favorite word there is power. The word is amandla, and it means power. And it's wonderful because it's the same word that's used for God's power and people's power. So in freedom songs and in church songs, the same word gets all mixed up in the same song and becomes a wonderful word. Here's a freedom song from South Africa. Oh God, Sifanmandla Kosi. God give us power to rip down prisons. Oh God, give us power to lift the people. Oh God, give us power. Oh God, give us courage to withstand hatred. God give us courage not to be bitter. Oh God, give us power and make us fearless. Oh God, give us power because we need it. And it's a whole different kind. I'd like to pose another key up there. Would be people's power in the sense of empowerment and in the sense of something that I think women know more about than men, and any kind of a group that is a minority group or an oppressed group knows, you know, a lot more about. And it's the kind of power where we're linking arms and getting strength from one another, and that kind of a power, which is a whole different kind of power than pitbull power, and totally different than the kind of pansy power that Mary was saying, where power is dirty and so you don't want to have anything to do with it. Somewhere kind of in the
middle. Yeah, the part you could interpret, and I think that's probably how we had it, both pitbull and pansy power could be my power or individualistic power, and you're talking about a we-ness of a power, a communal power in that sense. Yeah, over here and then over here.
It's still sparking on that. It's kind of a sense that power in that sense is linked very much to the ability to act. And I think what Mary was, the way I would think through what Mary was talking about, and I worry about this in our language, is we tend to think about action as positive, and we really don't have good concepts to talk about whatever the opposite of action is. In the older languages, you could talk about patient. And what we have is suffering, passivity, and those are all powerless. And it may be a good understanding of power has to encompass the fact that the person who acts also gets acted upon. And include that in some way, which is not simply helplessness, excluding the kind of agency you're talking about. And that's what I hear in there. We want to be able to do things.
I'd like to add another dimension to that, and in sort of disagree with it, if one thinks of how Christ behaved in his last days, Christ was passive. Christ did not argue. Christ was acted upon, and it was the power of his love which was redemptive. Because when you love the people who hate you, you redeem them and you change something within them, is what I learned from Christ's death on the cross, and that was God who died. And so I think our personal power of love is the only force in the world that can conquer anything. And how one expresses it, I don't.
One, two, three. One.
I guess the most powerful example of the church and political power for me is desegregation. And I think because we had eyes to see what was happening via television, but what grew out of the church and the nonviolent movement, and they became much more powerful than those that were armed with hoses and dogs. And we're able to effect change, and I really have a sense that, that somehow that is extreme power.
Might you say, how do you then transfer what she just said, or what you just said, to today's situation in the church and how we should be involved, if you like what the last two people have said? Two, three.
Well, picking up on that, I think there's a distinction between our suffering because something has happened to us from some external force, and the suffering that I think we see in the person of Jesus is suffering that we take upon us, the carrying of the cross sort of suffering, and I think that is a message for the church in how we act in a powerful way.
Well, I agree with Joy that Christ loved, but I feel that that's why they killed him. Because that very love, in saying yes to love, he said no very loudly to something else. He healed on the Sabbath, which was against the law. He did all kinds of things. He invited Zacchaeus down. He ate with publicans and sinners. He did everything against the laws of Moses. His loud yes to love was a no to everything that the Jewish people were standing for at that time. And in reference, in that same context, reference to what Charlie Mays was saying about why is it that the governments of the oppressive nations are so fearful, it is that very power of solidarity in love that they are terrified of. And I think that they conquer, they divide and conquer. That is the way they've acted in South Africa, you know, get people apart and not to allow that solidarity of that powerful love which says no to everything that they're doing.
Interesting point. Does that mean that we in our church, because the governments are not oppressing us or they're not afraid of us, I'm thinking us in the United States and Canada, maybe Germany, if she's here, is because, I lost my train of thought there.
Because we're not threatened.
Because, yeah, because they don't, or because we don't love. Yeah, here,
well,
then up here.
The one recent example of the opposite of that is the government's infiltration of churches in Arizona, mm-hmm. which were seen as a threat by our government because they were doing things with undocumented persons that our government did not like and that it called illegal. The churches said what they were doing was not illegal, and I think that still has to be tested by the courts. But we have had examples during the Vietnam War as well of government infiltration of church offices and going through files, and more recently surreptitious surveillance of church meetings, where apparently somebody in a government agency felt that there was a threat in what the churches were doing.
Do you think the government has that right? Should they be doing that?
They don't have the right.
They don't have the right? You're saying? Okay.
There's a court tape test of that going on, whether the government has the right without a prior court order, prior judicial order, to go into churches with undercover agents.
My husband and I were active in the sanctuary movement in our area in 1984. I was going to bring that also my point as well, but Catholic Social Services was broken into. All their files pertaining to undocumented Central American people in the area were taken. It was very obvious that it was a government job. And we were also concerned that our phones were being tapped. And at the time, it seemed to me that maybe we were being a little paranoid, but as it turned out, we really weren't at all, because in fact, just a year or so ago, it became public knowledge that, in fact, the FBI had conducted that kind of surveillance on all, quite a number of agencies that were working with the sanctuary movement.
Are these churches more faithful to the gospel than other churches that may keep their hands not dirty? Now, don't get into that. Is there a question? I was hearing that from our last forum, pushing that question, the challenge that we must be involved if we are to be the church. And other people are saying we must not be involved in that way if we're going to be the church. Is that a dilemma in your own lives at all, or in your own local churches? Yeah.
I think it really depends on the leadership of the church and where the people are in the church and what they're ready for. We're Presbyterians, and we're from Los Angeles, and we go to a church, a Presbyterian church, that during the 60s or the 50s and the early 60s was a very large congregation, 3,000, and now it's down to about 200 or 300. Well, during the early 60s or late 60s, during Vietnam and during a time there where there was a lot of controversy, a lot of people left the church, our church, and probably a lot of the Protestant denominations, because they weren't ready for a lot of the politics and perhaps didn't agree with it. And what we found that we've on occasion gone to other churches, and there's kind of a phenomenon going on where some of the more, I guess you might say, fundamentalist type churches, I mean, they're just booming. And we went to one church recently, and they had parking lot attendants, and I mean, people were just, you know, two services with parking lot attendants, and this is in Orange County, and in the Los Angeles area. And the thing that we found is that a lot of times in today's society, people are hurting so much in terms of their own lives, in terms of putting things together, in terms of trying to live their own lives, that they don't have the inclination or the energy to even think about some of these issues. I mean, they're just trying to
get energy and for their own lives. And so a lot of times it's up to the, I think, the leadership of the church, of the minister and so on, to be able to recognize where those people are and where they're ready to go. It's not just either or. Are they going to be committed or are they not? A lot has to do, I think, with the congregation, with, you know, what they're ready to hear and where they're ready to go.
I quoted in the dish team to Red up here today, quote from
Park. No, in the kitchen.
Kitchen? In the kitchen,
yeah,
on dish team.
Here.
Yeah, but Red's up there. Oh. Right. Anyway, from Harvey Cox's book, Feast of Fools, he says, the problem what we have is we have world changers who are not world celebrators, and world celebrators who are not world changers. Mm-hmm. And both lead to burnout, my mm-hmm. words. You know, that the problem is we need a healthy balance of both in order mm-hmm. to...
And Marty says the civil are not committed and the committed are not civil.
Yeah. Here and then over here.
That brings up an interesting issue. When I lived in Spokane and in North Idaho, which is for some reason become the right wing church capital of the world or something, it's at least common knowledge, may not be a fact, but it's at least common knowledge that the FBI and other government authorities were infiltrating the church of the Aryan Nation. Now,
well, they should be doing that.
Now, that's the question. if they are that type of political action, is that wrong? Those people are against my thoughts, and they're probably someday, if they were in power, if they did what they want to do, they might knock on your door and try to change your religion. Or send you to heaven, whichever it is. But that doesn't make it right for the government.
And the INS shouldn't have gone after the Bakers either. Yeah. Not INS, IRS.
IRS. INS goes after Sanctuary with it. IRS goes after the Bakers. Right. David, do you think you're here?
Sometimes it's helpful to twist the original issue a little bit and see what happens. And I'm sitting here listening to this. That the original topic sets it up as though the church starts out here, and the question is whether to move into politics or not. And at least for we new members of the ELCA, which has no policy at the moment, lots of battles going on, we might want to ask the question, isn't politics in the church already? And even in situations like hurting people and things, those people in effect have given up power to a certain kind, from my perspective, a certain kind of manipulation. I think the Baker case and things like that are much clearer. If we think of politics or power as domination and coercion, from my perspective, people in very conservative churches are being coerced in ways they may not recognize because they're doing something else. But I want to raise the general question, if isn't the church itself as a social body, isn't also, doesn't have a political dimension that we, like this title, forget. And
I just want to pick up on the politics already being there and the sense of coercion. I've had a person talk to me today who felt that the worship service last night, its content, and the matins this morning were coercion because a particular political point of view was expressed as worship. And so I think we might want to spend some time talking about that. And I have a sneaking suspicion that again, going back to what I said earlier about context, and again, since it's, you know, we've missed the action of what's happening at the Republican Party, my guess is the people, from what I've read in the paper this morning, who, you know, are again, just to use this as illustrative rather than my politics are left wing anyway, so that let that go with that. But in opposition to Michael Dukakis, George Bush used the G word, God. So and he got a lot of cheers and all of that kind of thing. So my guess is that when they go home on Sunday morning and hear things that meet that persuasion, they will if you were to ask them, was there politics in last night's service, they would have said, yeah, sure, you betcha. And those of us who kind of grooved in 3 weeks ago or a month ago at the Democratic kind of thing, said, no, it's wonderful worship. So, and I think that's part of what you also alluded to on the role of Holden. And maybe we could talk about politics in the church if we could recognize that it is here. Is it something that we want to do then in terms of lifting up issues to be debated? Or do we move over into advocacy? Because that seems to be, whether we're advocates or not, that seems to be when we cross the lines. And one of the fun things about the political and religious arena, I think, in the United States right now is everybody's crossing the lines. They're just crossing different ones. So that we've got advocates of the left and of the right, and they're in the churches, and we're having now this wonderful struggle. And I think we ought to acknowledge that. But I just want to raise up that issue about coercion. I'll stop there because I have another non-political example of where that goes in worship services that happen when I was at home. But let's just stop with that for a minute.
Okay, one person hasn't spoken up here, and then there, and then here, and then here.
Okay. No, not you? Okay. Then whichever order.
One, two, three.
I'm a Presbyterian pastor, and one of the things that has struck me personally that I'm able to go become far more political in my teaching without raising any objection than I am in my preaching. And I'm fortunate to be able to take it pretty far in my preaching without any objection either. But you brought up worship and the idea of coercion within worship.
Keep the petition out of the away from the sanctuary, the kind of, and it may be okay.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, Richard Rohr, who is a Franciscan priest, has said something that I'd like to repeat. He said that the church has always been involved in politics, and in fact, politics and the church have always been inseparable. The problem is that the church prior to just recent times, and he was speaking of the Catholic Church predominantly in Central America, up until recently, the church has always been aligned with the ruling class, with the powerful. The problem has only arisen as far as people's perception of the church being involved in politics. The problem arises when the church no longer stands with the powerful, but when it aligns itself with the poor, with the suffering. That's when the whole question of should the church be involved in politics suddenly surfaces, when in fact it's always been involved in politics. It's just changed sides. I think that my own feeling is just that as a culture, we have a very difficult time aligning ourselves with impoverished people, with powerless people. That's something we really still want to distance ourselves from. I think that's very prevalent attitude in churches. Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if you take churches or denominations and if they start to follow a candidate, as in the case that's happened here in the recent past, or they follow a certain issue, as in the case of your church in California, where they, and you lose a great number of people and you become the faithful to a certain issue, do you risk the problem of a denomination becoming a political party in itself? Instead of being involved in politics, now we become by eliminating all those people who disagree with us, become a party among ourselves.
Or another way of saying it is, how diverse can a congregation be and be
without alienating some people?
Or what's ever the opposite of diverse? How monolithic can a congregation be and still
homogeneous.
Be a congregation?
Homogeneous.
Homogeneous. Yeah, in that sense. Yeah.
Good question.
Any answers?
Well, we see those as oftentimes the growing congregations.
The homogeneous one.
Yeah, the like-minded.
Yeah. In fact, that's a strategy with some people's philosophy.
Right. Yeah.
There's like four Lutheran churches between our house and within 8 miles. There's one Catholic church.
We've got Wisconsin Synod. We've got several Lutherans. We've got one Catholic, one Methodist, and then all these Lutherans. It's just like we disagree with you, so we'll go over and make our church. Lutherans are the worst ones for. No, we have been astounded. Just within, from our house to Renton, there's like four Lutheran churches. And one of everybody else.
And thank goodness that has nothing to do with politics.
We choose to disagree, so we'll go off and make our own church. Mm-hmm. Plus, none of all those Lutheran churches are floundering on every. You were in the Renton area for a while, weren't you?
Not guilty.
Yes, I
started Congregation Renton.
Yeah. And he started what we started.
I started the true Lutheran church.
A like-minded people, right?
We had in that church, one of the council positions was called Minister for Political and Social Concerns, whose job was to raise issues to fight about. But I'd like to share just another story, because I'd like to have us really share some feelings about the issue I raised, because I think it is really a valid issue. I appreciated the person that raising it in the context at Holden, because I don't think that's a popular position, perhaps even here, that those were political events, those worship services. Again, in Renton, well, I went over to a Missouri Synod school because we had some kids there, and every once in a while I had to have the chapel service. That chapel service began in the following way. They did a Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag, to the Christian flag, and to the Bible. Was that a political event or worship event? Was it any more or less than what? I mean, I just want to raise that question. I mean, because I think that we just want to get some perception about, and that's why I led my remarks off with this sense about our context and what the dilemma is. Because why should it be acceptable for us pastors or leaders in the church or whatever to raise those kind of issues in teaching situations, but not in worship situations?
I think I would suggest one reason is that the sermon, at least, is a monologue, and teaching can be dialogic. I think that's one difference.
You haven't heard me teach, have you?
I did monologue. It can be dialogic. Sermons almost never can be dialogic.
My sermons always are.
We have American flags in our sanctuary.
Yeah, so up here and then over here.
Not
we
all
don't,
of us do.
We don't.
Okay. Please raise your hand if you want to make such wonderful comments. Over here.
I was going to say, I'm kind of tagging along on what was said before, that it seems that people have a problem, at least in the current situation with the current administration, when the church speaks out against the policies that are currently enforced. I mean, in this case, which tend to be against the conservative policies of the Reagan administration, it seems that we don't have a real strong policy about South Africa, but and you weren't, in the worship service last night, there wasn't anything said about we don't like what the United States policy is in South Africa, but it was maybe a little bit important. I don't know, was it implicit?
There was a prayer petition.
Yeah, it was in a prayer.
Right there.
And we have a woman in our parish in Port Angeles who every Sunday writes, please pray for the MIAs and the POWs that our government will get off its duff and quit lying to us and all of that. And I can't figure out where in the world she is politically. Is that a political petition or what? I can't figure out if she's right or left. I mean,
yes. Ingrid over here and then up here. One, two, three. Ingrid?
I'm not sure what the relevance of this comment is, but I think I'll make it anyhow.
Beware.
Being a person active in politics in Chicago, it's real clear that this is an irrelevant debate in the black community. The black community, every church was a Harold Washington church, in church services, during worship, after worship, in the evening, as an organizing tool, inviting the neighbors in to talk about Harold Washington during both of his campaigns. The church assumed that Jesus would have liked Harold Washington. Yeah. And this isn't just one church or one denomination. This was pervasive throughout the community. And maybe it's because the community's poor and doesn't have a lot of meeting houses. Black communities don't tend to have spaces to meet in outside of their churches, but they use their churches for everything. But the clear understanding of life among poor communities of people of color in Chicago is that the church belongs in the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. That there is hardly a barrier at all. It's an extremely permeable barrier, if there is a barrier. And it would just seem, this conversation would seem absurd. Mm-hmm. It would not compute. They would not, you know, there goes some white folks talking odd again about them. It wouldn't make any sense. And I can't, my gut feeling about it is that there's something right about what they're doing. But I can't really put it all in words, but I know that I know that what I've said is true.
Could I ask your question? Ingrid, did that work in Chicago because there was pretty much unanimity within the black community about Harold Washington's candidacy?
It may have worked because of that, but we that when there were mixed race rallies, which were clearly political rallies, including hats, that they began with a prayer, they ended with a prayer, there were frequent references to God throughout, you know, that the politics of a movement like that was so heartfelt and felt so strongly to be right. I mean, we were dismantling a machine that had been hurting people for 100
yeah.
years.
And historically in America, it's clear that the black church has always had very little separation between church and politics. I mean, it's
yeah.
been one and the same. You're absolutely right. But I'm just wondering if there were two black candidates running in Chicago
well,
at some
then
point,
it was, you know, then
and there were division in the black community, then what would be
involved with that? Maybe a good example would be the NAACP convention where there were people very, very disappointed that Jesse Jackson was not going to be the vice presidential candidate. And I felt that the presiding person, what is his name?
Hooks. Benjamin Hooks.
He was a healer.
Yeah.
They acted with such dignity and they treated Dukakis, you know, everybody left with some integrity there. They did and Dukakis did. And I feel that the black community does respond and move people appropriately. I get real moved by what I see them do, and that was an example for me. I was crying when I was watching that convention because I thought, you know, something's happening there.
But we've had an issue here, I think. We have to go back, the Aryan Nations out there in Idaho. Are we saying it's all right in Chicago because it's got Harold Washington in and a vote for Daily Machine, and those folks can't do that? And I know his wife would be very antsy with Pat Robertson running for president, who in effect runs a very much that same model.
But maybe it was, I don't think it was Harold Washington. I think it would be anybody. And certainly the black community has been using its churches as meeting places to talk about politics,
mm-hmm.
And has talked about politics in religious services for centuries.
In Christ, there is no east or west, nor church or state, possibly. You know, we're all one. Right? She's been patient up there. One, two, and then three over here. First.
Well, I just wanted to say, listening to this, I don't think that by the church not saying anything, you are not separating yourself from politics. You are affirming the status quo as it is. Because since the church is such a large group and such a powerful force in so many people's lives, then when they hear nothing different from the status quo at church, it affirms what is already there.
first of all, I should say that I believe that Jesus was political. I believe the church is political and should be political. But I think it's a little insensitive to for a group of people who talk about inclusive language and can easily talk about getting blacks into the community, Hispanics into the community, getting them into the church, but not accepting fellow Christians who happen to have a different political persuasion. I think political issues are appropriate. And political issues, first of all, I should add one thing, that when you have a captive audience like Matins, like the Vespers, or in a Bible study, for example, that's a place for proclamation. Now, proclamation can be political issues, but I don't think we should attack somebody of a different political persuasion. Lutherans are known, I think, for being we should be able to disagree without being disagreeable. And I think it is very, very domineering or using power in a poor manner when you attack somebody's beliefs in a situation like that. In the Vespers or something.
I think I was
well waiting
for you.
Oh, what?
I did. You pointed to me a lot.
Okay.
Oh, I was three about
that. Oh, I'm sorry. I never learned my numbers. Okay, three and then three.
That's okay. Two things I'd love to say. I agree with my daughter. I think she's right on. And dovetailing with what we've been talking about in the Psalms all week and with what you were saying up there too, when you only read Psalms and worship like, "As for me, I said in my prosperity, I shall never be moved. By thy favor, O Lord, thou hast established me as a strong mountain." That kind of thing, and read stuff in worship about we are rich because God has blessed us and that kind of stuff, then that's a definite political point of view. And it's just what Aaron was saying, and it's just what you were saying up there. It's just that it happens to be the status quo or the people in power, and so most folks aren't going to complain. So I feel a little strongly about that, and just having a flag there, no matter whose flag it is, it's very much a political statement in a worship service. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would never apologize or change my mind about doing anything about South Africa like that in a worship service is because in 1977, the Lutheran World Federation voted to make this particular issue, it's the only one that we have with Lutherans right now, a status confessionis issue. That means that it's equal to say Jesus is Lord is the same thing as to say apartheid must end right now, and any policy that upholds it must end. And so we're bound by our faith as Lutherans to do that. And if I can't do that in worship, then I've got to be able to do that in worship as well. I've got to be able to pray in public worship for apartheid to end.
Here, and then way in the back, and then here.
I just have a dumb question. From what I hear, no Christians voted for it, but Reagan got in. Does that mean that the majority of Americans are not Christians?
I don't know. I haven't heard that, but that's a good.
Are you wondering if Christians did not vote for Reagan?
Exit polls.
You're wondering if Christians did not vote for Reagan?
Yeah.
Is that?
Okay. Yeah.
Exit polls in 1984 indicated that 70% of U.S. Lutherans voted for Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. more than the population as a whole. So the Lutheran Church has been more pro-Reagan uh-huh. in its electoral behavior than the U.S. citizenry as a whole.
The man in the back?
I was going to say to you, Susan, that I think what Chuck is saying and what I feel, Chuck over there, not my brother here, is that what we're talking about here is not that what was offensive to me in the service last evening was not what you presented about the situation in South Africa or the politics of that, but the innuendo and the insinuation that one party represented justice more than the other. And that, I think, gets to be theological rather than political. That's the thing that I'm offended about. Also this morning, that's the innuendo, that's my point.
Yeah, I guess I didn't, I wasn't offended last night, and I think that all of my thinking in these last couple of weeks and on Rainbow Week has been that the world, all humanity, is created in a sisterhood and brotherhood in the image of God, in the womb of God. And if my brother and sister are being slaughtered, when God asked Cain, where is your brother Abel? I am being asked that question daily. Where is Jacob? Where are these people? They are being slaughtered by the very policies of our government. We are backing that. And if that is not a political issue and a party which is standing behind that, that we need to be prophetic about, I don't know what Christianity is. I feel we've got to lay our cards on the table when we see something that is demonic. And that is demonic. We cannot talk out of both sides of our mouth. We need to open our eyes and open our ears to see what's happening in the world. And I think that we as Christians have that responsibility. It is the responsibility of knowing. We know. And how do we act in that knowledge?
We were talking about this earlier. We were talking about how people have taken offense, especially when you brought on the Dutch Reformed Church, and we didn't talk about the church very much. Are we more upset at the government of South Africa because it's white and we think whites should know better than what they're doing than we are with Cambodia, for instance, where there's been a lot more slaughter than there has been in South Africa, because we feel that those are colored people and they just go around slaughtering each other because they can't govern themselves anyway? I mean, is that why we pick on South Africa a little harder? It's kind of like you're picking on you take your children and they disappoint you, and you pick on them a little harder because they're disappointing you than you are with the person that you think is helpless anyway. I mean,
well, South Africa is the only place in the world where, by basis of the color of your skin, you get it.
No, that's not a fact.
Based
on color of skin?
Yeah. That's right. It's the only place.
But it's not. But if you take Cambodia,
well,
based on your culture or based on your tribe, which may be the same thing as skin, or similar skin.
Good point, worthy of an.
And we're also, man, if you take the example of Adolf Hitler and the Japanese. All my life I grew up, the Germans committed all these massive atrocities and they're all terrible, which they all were, there's no question about it. But 90% of what I heard about atrocities have been German atrocities and not Japanese atrocities. Okay.
But the question
they were,
that,
they were
let me just call it, we got about 5 minutes max left and I want to get a formal break, but the question is not that question. The question is, how should the church then relate to that or not relate to that? Relate to that. And if you can phrase it that way, that's worthy of a whole other forum, what you just raised. Yeah.
I understand. My husband mentioned our church in California. A fellow who went to Nicaragua came back and tried to raise our awareness about that. At the end of his talk, and this is a Presbyterian minister, said, I suggest three things, and I have remembered it seems to work fairly well in our church where we have diverse opinions. And he said, number one, find out everything you can about whatever the concern is. That you can do in church. I mean, you can help do that at church. Number two, try to identify yourself with the pain, all of the pain on all of the sides, as much as you can, because that's what Christ would do. And then number three, as a Christian, try to take what you believe to be the responsible action from what you have found out from your information and identifying with the pain. But the thing is, in our church, as diverse as we are, the pastor does not identify for each person what that action should be. But he continues to challenge each one of us to decide for ourselves what that action should be. That's a possibility in number.
When I hear politics, the word politics, for me it is talk, talk, speech, speech, letters from the bishops, and nobody does it. I think it's more important to influence the congregation to start doing something instead of talking and politicizing it. Number two problem I have only two problems, so I'm
very good.
Number two problem is, if we become more and more political, do we at the same time become less and less spiritual? And I don't have the answer, it's a question I struggle with.
I have no problem with the church being political, because I'm assuming that the church today is a sociological entity over against Luther's understanding of a functional and the church and the Holy Roman Empire. My problem has always been on what level of discourse can I address the government in a pluralistic society. Perhaps I could say it best, I'm sitting on the outside of the circle so the rocks don't get thrown this way. I can understand how Democrats can be Christians, but I've never understood how Democrats could be Americans. Let me put it another way to get across the dilemma. I think so many times the moral majority, and what I hear so many saying here from a different political perspective, still are operating under the same assumption, although they come out with very different agendas, namely that the government is expected to somehow or other legislate their ethical view of the world. I question whether that's an American understanding of government. And once again, I don't know just where to go with this. But I really hesitate on speaking out, assuming that somehow or other the government must adopt my religious viewpoint.
Second to the last word.
When we talk politics in a group like this, and politicians talk politics, I think we have to realize you're not talking the same ball game.
Yeah.
Politician, whether they're Republican, Democrat, Independent, or whatever they are generally elected for a two-year term. What do you think their main issue is?
Re-election.
How many people talk to them about issues like this? These issues very seldom reach the ears of a politician. They'll talk about South Africa, but as far as their average voter and the people that put them in office, they could care less about South Africa. So you have to realize we're talking about two different, when we talk politics, we're talking two different things.
Charlie.
Well, I would like to respond to the, is there an inverse relationship between becoming more political and more spiritual?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it can, I mean, being a preacher, I'll try to get in everything here, including Chuck's question. Part of our dilemma in Chuck's question is to move something out of the theoretical into the practical for us in this country means partisan politics. I don't think that's a big deal. I think we have to use some judgment and discernment, but that's the only way we're going to get the freight carried. Is to get it someplace loaded, and we've got two big options in this country. So I think, and our dilemma gets to be at that point, I think. But related to that, getting down to the practical, the mundane, the ordinary, the way life really is, and whether that kind of political action is spiritual, I have a kind of a cliche that we really have done ourselves an enormous disservice in the church by dividing the spiritual off from the created order. And I think we would agree with these two little kinds of premises. First of all, the spiritual is that which is created by the Spirit of God. Would that be a fairly good definition of what is spiritual?
No.
And then when one looks at the first statement in Genesis, the Spirit of God brooded, hovered over this chaos, and the creation came. The creation is a spiritual creation. And the more we care about and when you look at some of the most spiritual people that have arisen on the scene in our lifetimes, Mahatma Gandhi, very political person, incredibly spiritual. And I think of somebody like Medardo Gomez, incredible guy. And he's terribly political. And Tutu and all other kinds of folks that we could name. That's an interesting paradox, I think. But I think that when we find that kind of connection, we can maybe get on with the practical thing. And I think there probably is a time, as Ecclesiastes says, for scattering and picking up, and there may be a time in this country for being Republican, and there may be a time for being Democrat. And God help us make the choices.
Right.
Right.
Well, like, I kind of judge a good form is if the conversation continues after hours and on to the next day in small little groups. I think that this has been a good form, and I thank you all for coming.